welcome to Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh, and I'm joined, as always, by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm doing great, David. I'm doing great. What about yourself?
Well, I have had a rough week. I've been in and out of the Princess Anne Eye Hospital, which is luckily not that far from our offices, so I've been having some difficulties, but I am seem to be on the mend, so I'm doing much better than I was a week ago.
Yes, listeners, obviously this is an audio podcast, not a video podcast, but David has a rather Clint Eastwood-like squint right now. It's very impressive. He looks very menacing.
Oh, boy. I think that's if I'm going to be menacing, that's the only way it's going to happen is through an eye injury. Okay. All right, good. So a lot has been going on since our last episode, Frank. But in the news, I think that we probably need to provide some historical context for, or at least try to.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are three things in the main we want to talk about today. The first is the removal of the Silent Sam statue in North Carolina at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. The second is the verdicts last Tuesday that were simultaneous, the verdicts in the Manafort case, the case against Paul Manafort in federal court in Virginia, and the simultaneous pleas by Michael Cohen in New York last Tuesday, both for basically financial irregularities associated with their political activities. And the third thing is the death over the weekend of Senator John McCain. So these things have kind of all followed one on the other since our last episode. So it's more of a kind of summer potpourri episode, but we're going to kind of have a lightning round and deal with these things. Yes. But David, I wanted to shut up, actually. I want me to shut up and listen to you for a change, because I want to hear your response. We did an episode months ago about Confederate monuments.
About a year ago, yeah.
Yeah, but about the removal of the Silent Sam statue, because you're an alumnus of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. You're a historian of the Civil War, so I wanted to kind of turn the floor over to you to hear your thoughts about the removal.
Sure. I've been thinking a lot about Silent Sam, over the past week since the statue has been pulled down.
Can you provide some context?
Yeah, so the background to this, the Silent Sam Memorial was a statue on the campus of UNC Chapel Hill. It's right on the entrance to campus coming off of Jefferson Davis Highway. Jefferson Davis Highway. It's a statue of a Confederate soldier. He's holding a rifle. He's called Silent Sam because he actually doesn't have a carriage box for his rifle, so he actually couldn't fire his gun if he wanted to. He is a statue that was dedicated in 1913 to the men who left the University of North Carolina to go fight for the Confederacy.
Who put it up?
So it was ostensibly given by the United Daughters of the Confederacy, although much of the money raised for the statue was actually raised in 1911 when the University of North Carolina gave honorary degrees to all of its former students who left and to go fight and didn't finish their degrees. Ostensibly the UDC paid for it or gave the statue, although the money came from lots of places. The person who, in fact, financed a large portion of it and gave the dedicatory speech was a guy named Julian Shakespeare Carr, who was always called General Carr in his retirement, although he never actually was a general in the war. I think he was like a captain or something and got promoted after Appomattox.
Giving self-promotion.
He became a leading industrialist in North Carolina. He had a tobacco company and a textile company, and he was involved in Democratic politics in North Carolina and involved in lots of veterans organizations. And he gave a really extraordinary speech, the dedication, which is now available online, largely actually, in fact, to two of my friends.
Uncovered by graduate students.
Hillary Green and Adam Dombey were the ones who really made this. I mean, the speech was always available at that Southern Historical Collection at UNC where Carr's papers are, but Hillary and Adam have made the speech sort of more well-known by digitizing and transcribing the speech. And Carr in his dedication is pretty clear about what the statue is about. It's about not only honoring these former soldiers, but about maintaining white supremacy. He says, look, I was with Lee at Appomattox. I came back, and he says, 50 feet from where we are today, where the statue is, I horsewhipped, and to use his phrase, a Negro woman who, you know, refused to let somebody else pass on the sidewalk. And, you know, the linkage there between saying, look, we may have been defeated in war, but that doesn't change the status of race relations in the South, that black women and African Americans more broadly are second-class citizens. And this statue is here to demonstrate that. It's pretty clear throughout his speech. You know, and so I think it's one of the sort of more pressing examples when people say, well, look, this is a monument to heritage, not hate, or what have you. This is a monument that very clearly is embedded with all kinds of, you know, deeply racist meanings in its origin, and really has been a source of conflict on UNC campus really from the time, well before when I was a student there, obviously through the present day, to have such a visible symbol of white supremacy in the Confederacy, you know, in the entrance to campus. You know, the university has tried at various points in time to try to sort of contextualize the statue. There's another monument not far from it that was put up about 10, 12 years ago to the forgotten founders of the universities, which was the sort of monument to the slaves who helped build campus buildings and whatnot. Although that monument tends to look more like a picnic table than like the 20-foot tall statue. You know, and UNC, like other Southern universities, has been wrestling with its, you know, the legacy of slavery and white supremacy in the history of the institutions.
And some Northern universities.
And some British universities.
Yeah. So what happened to the statue then, David, last week?
Well, so what happened to the statue last week is that a group of student protesters basically pulled the statue down off of its pedestal. The pedestal is still there. The pedestal has some nicer bronze, nice for white supremacist, you know, engravings, but they're nice some bronze engravings of a student who's being sort of tapped on the shoulder. So that pedestal is still there, but the statue itself is gone. And what's going to happen with that site remains up in the air. There was one member of the North Carolina Board of Governors, which is sort of the Board of Trustees kinds of thing, who said that he's going to push to have the statue put back up, but the status of the statue remains unclear at this point. What's going to happen?
Where is the statue physically?
Right now, they toted it off in a dump truck to a secured, undisclosed location.
Right, okay.
Who knows?
Was it damaged? Because they pulled the one down in Durham last year and it crumbled, didn't it?
Yeah, yes. Yeah,
because
this,
it was
it seems like this one was a slightly better made one than the one in Durham. The one in Durham, of course, Durham is the next city over from Chapel Hill, where 9 months ago protesters pulled down a Confederate statue in front of the courthouse.
So, as an alum,
yes,
and as a historian of the Civil War, mm-hmm. and as somebody who's obviously given this a lot of thought, what are your feelings and thoughts about this?
I'm very happy that statue is gone. I'd like, actually, if they left the pedestal, because I think the empty pedestal is an interesting symbolic space. So you could say, look, this is where the statue was. And so you're not erasing the statue from the landscape, and you're giving people a vehicle to think about the place where it was. You know, thinking about Confederate monuments, there's Confederate monuments all over the place, and I think we don't necessarily need to take them all out. I think I'm okay with keeping the ones on the battlefield and those kinds of ones that are on, you know, site-specific kinds of places. But the ones who are in public spaces like university campuses and in front of courthouses, ones that are designed very much to be mechanisms of racial intimidation, you know, those ones I think should pretty much all come down. I mean, the thing about the Silent Sam Memorial is that, like many Confederate memorials, it's not put up right after the war. It's not put up, you know, 10, 20, 30 years. It's put up 50 years after the war is over. And it's, you know, put up in the context of segregation. It's put up in the context of widespread racial violence. I mean, it's put up to reaffirm a certain kind of order, and to designate African Americans as second class citizens. And so it's not really a Civil War memorial, it's really a white supremacy memorial. At least that's how I would think of most of them. I like very much thinking about sort of this local area in North Carolina. Duke University in Durham, the next town over, also had a Confederate monument. They had a statue to Robert E. Lee as part of its chapel. Right next to Thomas Jefferson, in fact, they had statues of the two of them next to each other. And somebody went at the Robert E. Lee statue with a hammer and damaged it. And the university decided to take down the Robert E. Lee statue and just leave an empty space. So there's a, you know, an empty alcove in the chapel where Lee was. And I think the creating that sort of negative space is an interesting way to sort of grapple with, you know, that particular monument's legacy.
I've got two responses to that, or two questions for you, really. One is, does it make a difference in your mind that Duke is a private university and the University of North Carolina is a public university, which is to say publicly funded?
Indeed, yeah. Well, I think it made it easier for Duke to take the statue down of Robert E. Lee, because they were able to just say, look, right, we're taking that down, done. You know, Chapel Hill at this point has having difficulties because there are state laws about taking things down and moving and altering monuments. And, you know, the governor has told Chapel Hill essentially it's okay to take the statue down, but various state legislators have said no, the law says you can't take it down. And so there's a whole bunch of mechanisms that make it more difficult for Chapel Hill to make a decision about Silent Sam, in as much as it's, you know, not only the institution, but the sort of broader government framework. But in some ways, because it is an institution that's supposed to be a university for the people of North Carolina, and in as much as that statute says that a certain percentage, you know, 30-40% of the population of North Carolina is not welcome there by its very presence, I think that in some ways is all the more reason to take it down. Because it is it's an exclusionary monument. It's not, in some ways, it is signifying as a gateway to the campus. Here is a land that's set aside for a certain vision of who North Carolinians are and what this university stands for. And if you, you know, get your way along Jefferson Davis Highway to somewhere else, if that's where you, you know, if you don't fit into that mold. I'm happy it's gone.
My second question concerns, I like your idea of the empty pedestal, and it reminds me, you know, there's an empty plinth in Trafalgar Square, sure. And occasionally they put temporary monuments there. Would you like to see the pedestal? I mean, I like your concept of negative space. I think that's really interesting. But could it be used on a temporary basis? So could you put a monument up to, I don't know, civil rights activists from
have a rotating
yes.
Well, so I jokingly on Twitter the other day posted I think they should replace it with one of the Union soldiers who helped to liberate campus and abolish slavery, because in 1865 when Joseph Johnson's army is retreating and Sherman's army is advancing, one of the places where Sherman's army camps out is on UNC campus, because it's a big open space.
Right.
It's good for setting up tents. And actually one of the one of Sherman's subordinates actually ended up marrying the daughter of the president of the university, which caused a big scandal. You know, I thought maybe having a statue to one of a Union soldier would be an interesting sort of juxtaposition. Having a monument to a civil rights activist, I think would be great. Having a monument to a freed slave, Abraham Galloway, or some other local African American leader from the era would be an interesting replacement for Silent Sam.
What do you think is going to happen?
That's a remark. I'm hoping that. I think there's going to be a fight in the next few months. There was a rally a couple days ago. It looks like there might be more of the rallies in the future in which people who are in favor of Silent Sam are rallying around it. But I'm not sure. I think we're still in a point, and I think the situation at UVA a year ago, I think, is indicative of this, in which these kinds of symbols are still, they're coming down, but I think there's still a fight to be had about how they're coming down and when they're coming down. We've had lots of Confederate statues come down in Baltimore and in New Orleans and a bunch of other places, but I think the number of Confederate statues that are still up in towns and cities throughout the South is still in the hundreds and thousands.
Does it matter to you? I mean, one of the criticisms that's been made by people who oppose the removal of the statue is that this was illegal, this was vandalism, this wasn't. When the city of New Orleans took down statues, that was the city of New Orleans. Yeah. But these were violent protesters, allegedly, who took the law into their own hands to tear it down. Outside agitators.
So my reading of that is that there are, at least my reading of North Carolina law is that there are sort of mechanisms for taking things down if you want to take things down. The legal barriers to it are so profoundly high that it's basically impossible. And so in some ways, having a legal mechanism, but one that is inaccessible, is the same as saying it's illegal to take them down. And in my mind, violating an unjust law might be breaking the law, but it's not, wrong. I think you have a moral obligation in some ways to stand up to unjust laws. I think the history of the United States is in some ways built upon standing up to unjust laws. Helping fugitive slaves was breaking the law, and those are the good guys.
Well, speaking of the law, Sam came down, I think, this is a very awkward segue, on Monday, I think Monday evening, and then on Tuesday evening our time here in the UK, it was extraordinary because it was around 10 o'clock at night, and I happened to be on social media at that time, and it exploded because within minutes, Paul Manafort was found guilty in federal court in Virginia. Now, it should be said that Manafort was tried for basically financial shenanigans unrelated as yet to the Trump campaign. And then simultaneously in federal court in New York, Michael Cohen, Donald Trump's self-described fixer, pleaded guilty. Both of them were found guilty or pled guilty to 8 different counts. Manafort was, there were 10 additional counts in the Manafort trial that the jury was unable to reach a verdict on.
Because of one juror.
Yeah. Well, that's the system. And so this was pretty big news, let's say, I think. Not least because, although a number of people have already been found guilty because of their activities in association with Trump's campaign, or their activities in association with President Trump. All of those to this point had been dismissed as low-level people who Trump didn't know very well, or they weren't important, et cetera, et cetera. Whether that was true or not is debatable. However, Manafort was Trump's campaign manager for several months during his presidential campaign, and Michael Cohen, as Trump's so-called fixer, was Trump's lawyer, or one of Trump's lawyers, and certainly very close to Trump personally for over a decade.
Sure.
So these are two individuals who are quite close to, or have been quite close to, President Trump, both before he became president and during his campaign to become president. Mm. How significant do you think these verdicts or these outcomes are, David?
I think these are pretty significant. You know, I'm trying to think of, you know, what are the right historical analogies for where we are in this process.
Feels like we're getting into Watergate territory.
It feels like we're getting into Watergate. I mean, and Trump actually compared Michael Cohen to Dean. You know, and he said, like, you know, look, here's somebody who is, you know, a traitor in a way for betraying the confidence of his client, if you will.
That is John Dean, who was White House counsel to Nixon. Sure.
And so I think we are really in Watergate territory, or at least that seems like the closest analog. Where we are in the Watergate chronology, though, I think that might be a little bit harder to nail down. I've been trying to think out where we are. I think we're sort of in March of 74, if I were to pick a time period in the Watergate chronology.
We're moving pretty quickly then, because we're moving much more quickly than the Watergate chronology.
Well, in as much as that's when you have the indictment of the Watergate 7. So you've got H.R. Haldeman and John Ehrlichman and John Mitchell and four other guys, I don't remember who they are, who are, you know, indicted for their involvement in Watergate and the cover-up. And that is to say people who were close to the president, and Nixon, of course, is the unindicted co-conspirator among those seven. But one of the things that the Nixon administration did after the indictment of the Watergate 7 is they said, look, those guys caused the problem. The president has no responsibility for it. And I think the Trump administration is very much doing the same thing right now, where they're placing, you know, they're trying to distance themselves, the president, from the people that were very, very close to the president, which was extraordinarily hard to do. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But that, I think, is the sort of point we're at right now. In as much as, you know, in both the Watergate situation and today, the prosecutors are working from the outside in and trying to, you know, get the low-level people first and get them to testify in exchange for immunity or for reduced sentences or what have you.
Well, that's how you do it. That's right?
And so I think there's a similarity in that respect. The timeline for Watergate, you know, Watergate lasted a lot longer than people remember it did. You know, it took more than 2 years between when the break-in happened and was first discovered and then, you know, Nixon's eventual resignation. And so, you know, how we, and trying to figure out, this is, I think, a different world in which the media works, and so I think, and the ways in which prosecutors work. But that's my initial guess. How does it fit to your mind?
Well, I'd say a couple of things. One thing that strikes me is one of the talking points that Trump's defenders have used, particularly to attack the Mueller inquiry, is that it's taking so long. And with regard to Cohen, at least, it hasn't taken long at all. And I know the Cohen thing is separate from the Mueller inquiry, but to some extent it's a spinoff of it. And Mueller gave it to the prosecutor's office in the Southern District of New York, I think, to keep it separate. But leaving aside those kind of legal niceties, you know, the FBI raided Cohen's office in April. And here we are in at the end of August, and you know, he pled guilty to 8 different counts and clearly is cooperating with the government, which I think is interesting. So I think it's actually been moving more quickly than perhaps we think. I think your observation is a correct one. Watergate took a lot longer than people remember, and it unfolded over really a couple of years. I think this is likely to go the same way. The media environment we're in and the political ecosystem we now operate in is very, very different, where things seem to be happening much more quickly. And so Mueller's rather deliberate approach seems to be really, really slow. We don't know what Mueller's doing, and we don't know what he has, because he seems to be the only person involved in our current culture who doesn't talk all the time. and isn't on Twitter like the president. So it seems to me, so I have two responses, or a response to each of these things. Both of them are major developments to my mind, and taken together, Tuesday was a bad day for President Trump and his administration. I think The Manafort verdict is important because it demonstrates that Mueller has something and that the Mueller inquiry is legitimate, notwithstanding the opposition of some in Congress and in the media among supporters of President Trump. It will be very difficult, for President Trump, I think, to fire Mueller and to try and stop that inquiry. It doesn't mean he won't attempt to do so, but I think it would be...
Yeah, predicting what the president's going to do at this point is...
But I think it would be very, very difficult for him to try and interfere with that. So I think that's important. I think the Cohen stuff and the Cohen pleas are really important because Cohen... in making his plea, he asserted that he acted at the direction of a candidate for federal office, that's the president.
Which is an odd way of phrasing, you know.
To make the payments to, I think, Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal. That's a direct link both to the campaign and to the president and a violation of campaign finance law. Whether that's the biggest crime, I don't know. But that seems to me to be a really crucial step. I think that Mueller's got something, and I think it's going to take a long time for it to come out. But ironically, or perhaps appropriately, it seems to me that the Stormy Daniels track in this scandal might be the one that presents greater danger to President Trump, at least at the moment. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's probably right. The other historical analogy that jumps out to me, the thing that sort of I'm reminded of in the Manafort and Cohen case, are two sets of cases that are actually also coming out of the Southern District of New York from the late 1980s. The first are the insider trading cases of Michael Milliken and Ivan Boesky, which were very, you know, public front page New York Times cases of financial malfeasance. And the John Gotti trial, which happened about the same time. He was the head of the Gambino crime family.
The Teflon Don.
And what strikes me about those cases is both of those are really, you know, people who probably committed much bigger crimes, but they ended up getting convicted of, you know, smaller version, you know, smaller crimes of things like racketeering and conspiracy and what have you. And
well, they got Capone on tax evasion, basically, right?
Exactly.
Alphonse Capone, as the president called him.
Yes, exactly. Well, they're good friends. So they, but the thing that strikes me, the reason why those jump out to me is a couplefold. One is, you know, those were very complex investigations for complex levels of crimes, much in the same way as the stuff involving Trump and Manafort and Cohen. The relationships are complicated. These aren't simple, you know, easy to prosecute crimes. They require a great deal of attention to detail and a great deal of coordination in order to sort of, you get the small fish and then you work your way up to the...
And a lot of forensic accounting.
Exactly. Both of those trials happen at the same point, I think, in which Donald Trump rises to public prominence as a media figure. This is the same point in time in which Donald Trump gets a divorce from Ivana and has the affair with Marla Maples and the front page of the Washington Post and all that kind of stuff.
New York Post.
Thank you. Sorry. He's on the Washington Post probably too, but New York Post.
Big difference between the New York Post and the Washington Post.
Yes, that's true. But the other sort of interesting link between those trials and today is that the district attorney for the Southern District of New York was Rudy Giuliani, who, of course, is Donald Trump's lawyer. And two of the people who were working with Rudy Giuliani on those cases were Robert Mueller and James Comey. So there are, you know, people who had the ways in which, you know, Mueller's proceeding in this case is very much reminiscent of how one prosecutes, and I don't want to, like, say Donald Trump's a gangster, but maybe I do. You know, the way in which the investigation is proceeding is very much along those lines, where you are slowly and methodically working your way up towards whatever the eventual target is.
Well, yes. So a couple of things. I mean, Giuliani is interesting in this because, as you're right to remind us, I mean, he made his name and reputation as a pretty hard-nosed prosecutor in New York. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say I think Rudy might have lost his fastball a little bit. But the one thing I would also say is, Rudy, please don't stop talking. You're incredibly amusing, and every time he makes an appearance in defense of Trump, it's insane. And I wonder, it's almost like performance art, and he contradicts himself. I mean, he's the perfect lawyer for President Trump. But the interesting thing is, in terms of the Gotti case, for example, the key evidence against Gotti was provided by Sammy the Bull Gravano, who testified against Gotti. And Gravano, I think 18 or 19 people, many on behalf of Gotti, and testified against him in exchange for immunity. Now, Giuliani, the other day, in defending President Trump, went after Michael Cohen, and you'd expect him to do so because he's Trump's lawyer.
Yeah.
But he went after his integrity. He attacked Cohen's integrity and thus his credibility. Well, the people who flip, as Trump put it, and give testimony in exchange for immunity or whatever deal he might have made, have done bad things themselves. Yeah. That's the reason you're talking to them. And so this doesn't surprise me. So you know, testifying against John Gotti didn't make Sammy Gravano a good guy or innocent. No. But that's how you get Gotti. Yeah. And similar, the same thing will happen about maybe happening to Trump. And it was interesting because in his Fox News interview last week, after all these legal proceedings, President Trump went on a riff where he really did sound like Tony Soprano, complaining about people flipping. Yeah. And turning on each other and all this. And it did sound
They're both from Queens.
Yes. but it also... It was self-serving on Trump's part, but he didn't seem to understand both the way the law works. Mm. And as somebody who's been in New York real estate and comes from Queens, you'd think he'd understand that this is the way it goes. I mean, he said this... He said, flipping should be illegal. As though this, you know... It was a very bizarre moment, and it struck me that they really are getting close. And in the past in the days after the events on Tuesday occurred, we had David Pecker from the National Enquirer, who seems to have been a keeper of Trump's secrets. It's been revealed that he's now cooperating with the government and may or may not have a safe full of information about Trump.
Mm.
I don't know whether that's true or not. We will find out in due course, I suppose. But Pecker seems to be talking. And also Alan Weisselberg, who is the chief financial officer for Trump International. They're getting people very close to President Trump to cooperate with the government. And these are people who I think are facing serious legal jeopardy themselves and thus, in Donald Trump's parlance, are flipping against him. And this is bad news for the president. Now, I don't know how it plays out.
No.
Because ultimately, impeachment is a political decision and a political act. And the polls are showing that Trump's support among Republicans has remained rock solid. But this seems to be, it seems to me the past few days have represented a real change.
So we don't know what Mueller has. And we know, you know, right now all we're getting are puzzle pieces, and we don't know what the picture looks like yet. And Mueller presumably has some idea, more of a picture than we do. But whatever the picture is, seems to be a very complicated picture, right? It's not a... it's not an easy to discern what exactly happened and what crimes, if any, President Trump committed, and how this is going to play out. And I think that's going to have really important political ramifications, in as much as scandals that have legs tend to be scandals that are easy for people to understand. If we think back to the Bill Clinton administration, Whitewater was a scandal within Washington, but I don't think it really had reverberations with the American populace because it involves financial malfeasance with a real estate deal, which is complicated and boring.
Alleged.
but
it was complicated and boring.
Monica is not complicated and boring. Monica is simple and easy to understand, and that's why that part of the Clinton, whatever it is, ended up getting legs politically and led to impeachment is because it was something that I think cut through to the people who, you know, the average American who doesn't, you know, stay on the news 24 hours a day. And so I don't know what the version of, you know, what Donald Trump's Monica is going to be.
Well,
what
I part think, of the scandal no, is going to no, actually... David, I think we had that last week, though. That's another reason why I think Cohen's important. Cohen testified.
Yes.
He said, and this is something people can understand, basically, I paid the porn star and the Playboy bunny to keep quiet at the behest of the now president.
Yes.
You know, and I did so secretly. I mean, that seems to me to be a scenario that makes sense to people in a way that Russian collusion, and collusion's hard to prove. Mm. And you know, the Russia story is really important. I think the story of Trump's ties to Russia, which are likely financial, is a really important one. But you're right, the complexity of it and the opacity of the, a lot of the evidence, at least what we know at the moment, makes it confusing.
Yeah.
I mean, I follow pretty closely, and even I get confused sometimes. Yes. Like, who are we talking about now? But the people know who Stormy Daniels is. And Michael Avenatti is making it sure that we don't forget who she is. Mm. You know, I think that I guess I'm agreeing with you, but I think the answer might be right in front of us, because I think what Cohen testified to and that aspect of it is a real problem for President Trump, because it's easy for people to understand.
All right, we will see how that unfolds out and plays over the next weeks, months, years.
Yeah. We will. Yeah. I mean, we should talk about impeachment at another time. I think we'll have the opportunity.
Yes, and the Watergate analogies will come up again. All right, our third topic, we wanted to talk a little bit about Senator John McCain and his legacy. John McCain, of course, the longtime senator from Arizona who passed away over the weekend after many years in the U.S. Senate. What are your initial thoughts about his legacy, Frank?
I think McCain's legacy is complex and often contradictory, which is to say it's a human legacy. So he had a reputation as this maverick, and I want to talk about that in a second. And that was the adjective that was always attached to him. He was a complicated guy. So on one hand, and now I'm thinking about him as a senator, not to discuss his military career before that, but he was fairly bellicose in his foreign policy. And indeed, he was all in on wars in the wider Middle East after 9/11. By the same token, he was a committed internationalist in the sense that he believed in working with allies, standing by allies. There's no way he would ever have disdained a NATO ally like Montenegro, the way President Trump did last month. He was committed to a kind of international order and a stable international state system, with the United States at its head, unquestionably. But he was committed to international institutions in a way that I think was admirable, particularly in light of what we've seen subsequently. He, while pursuing this bellicose foreign policy, was forthright and unequivocal in his opposition to torture.
Yes.
After 9/11, and I think that his legacy is complicated. In terms of politics, he's also complicated. There was much to like. I mean, I remember the Straight Talk Express campaign in 2000, and he could be I didn't participate. I was following it vicariously through the news like everybody else, but he could be charming and funny and was an underdog and all that sort of thing. But he's also the guy who, because of his desire to win in 2008, brought Sarah Palin into his campaign and was willing to bring Sarah Palin into the White House, a heartbeat away, as the cliche goes, from the presidency, a woman who was manifestly unqualified for the role. And the road from Palinism to Trumpism is a short one, and I think Senator McCain helped build that road. Yeah. And although he resisted aspects of President Trump's agenda, if we can call it that, he helped steal that seat, the Merrick Garland seat.
Yes, he did.
He voted to confirm. You know, this. He's become a kind of the Republican all liberals love.
Yeah.
But I don't think there's much substance to that. What do you think?
I think his reputation as a maverick is one that he cultivated.
Very skillfully.
Yeah, I think he was very artful in how he used the media. He tried to portray himself as always being very informal and honest, but I think he was doing that in a very, I don't want to say calculated, but at least thoughtful kind of way. You know, if you look at his voting record, he was a very conservative senator, and you know, he had the occasional time where he didn't vote the party line, but
memorably voting against the legislation to repeal Obamacare.
But in lots of other ways, he was, you know, very, very conservative. He, you know, one of the first things he took a stand on when he got elected to Congress, when he was in the House before he was in the Senate, was standing up against Martin Luther King Day. And, you know, he was against gay marriage.
Although, in fairness, he did admit he was wrong on Martin Luther King Day.
And he also admitted he was wrong on Iraq. You know, and so somebody who owned up to his mistakes, he seemed to have been, you know, a more decent gentleman and politician in that respect than lots of people are, in as much as he recognizes when he, you know, took positions in the past that he later regretted. But he was a very conservative senator who occasionally did things that weren't what the party apparatus wanted him to do. I don't really think that makes him a maverick particularly. I think that was, you know, in some ways as much a public image as anything else. His legislative accomplishments, I think he was because of his military service and because of the way he sort of thought about the country, I think he, you know, is a hero for his conduct really throughout his life. But his legislative accomplishments are on the thin side in some ways. If you look at...
He's been called a lion of the Senate. Are you saying that's, or a titan? Are you saying that's?
Well, there's a couple of things about.
We should admit we're speaking within 48 hours of his death, and it's always a little unseemly to us, and almost impossible to assess somebody's legacy immediately after their death.
To be sure, I mean, one of the things about being in the Senate is. A different kind of institution than the House. It's different than being than the presidency. You know, there are lots of people who are, like McCain, people who are in the Senate for 30 years, right? There's lots of people who have very lengthy terms of office in the Senate and like McCain, have not a huge legislative record to, you know, show for it particularly. That doesn't mean they're not important senators. There's lots of things that one can do in the Senate in terms of oversight, in terms of their role, in terms of confirmations, and they're really important even if they aren't actually passed that many laws. One of the roles the Senate has traditionally played is in saying no to things, as being sort of a brake on legislation, and the power that individual senators have to stop government action is quite profound, and so there's a way, sort of a negative legislative record one could have. Not to sort of herald this as a good guy, but you know, Jesse Helms was a very successful senator by saying no repeatedly to things and holding up legislation that he opposed. I disagree with Jesse Helms on everything, but you know, in terms of somebody who was effectively using the Senate. And so I think McCain did lots of important work for veterans and for the military and what have you. His standing up to torture, I think, is particularly noteworthy.
Let's not forget he was a victim of torture. For five and a half years.
So when he spoke about torture, he had a gravitas that nobody else could.
And eschewed the opportunity to both stop his torture and secure an early release.
Sure.
By basically betraying the men who he was imprisoned with, and he refused to do so.
I think, as many listeners know, he is the son and grandson of U.S. admirals, so he was not only a prisoner of war in Vietnam, but a high-value prisoner of war, one whose, you know, status had particular utility for the North.
I think that family connection plus the long-standing time or long duration in the Senate are both important, because I think what he was a conservative with a small C, which is to say he was an institutionalist. He venerated institutions or certain institutions and valued their traditions, whether it was the Navy or the Senate. And so I think he was a giant of the Senate in that way. And I think he was sincere in lamenting the changes in politics that have occurred in the past generation, but particularly the past 10 or 15 years. So he was the kind of senator who reached across the aisle, not necessarily to pass legislation, although the McCain-Feingold Act was his great achievement, although it's been gutted by the Supreme Court, which was a bipartisan piece of campaign finance reform. But the accounts, and we've heard a lot of this in the past 24 hours, and in, really in the past year since McCain was diagnosed with brain cancer, of collaborating and cooperating across the aisle, overseas fact-finding missions, not junkets to play golf in Scotland, but kind of tough visits to Afghanistan and Iraq, where he would go with, among other people, Senator Hillary Clinton. And apparently Hillary Clinton and McCain really bonded and became sincere friends, I think, on a trip to Russia, in part because Clinton demonstrated to McCain that she too was committed to the Senate and its traditions. And this, and so I think McCain really believed in the Senate and was very and established warm friendships with people across the aisle who were fellow senators, like John Kerry, like Joe Biden, like Hillary Clinton, like Russ Feingold. And this is one of the reasons, and I think sincerely, that he has the reputation he does, even if the legislative record is rather
thin. Now, I mean, one of the things about the Senate that tends to traditionally had promoted that kind of behavior was the fact that so many people were in the Senate for such extended periods of time. That if you're in the Senate with somebody in a club of 100 people, for 30 years, even if you have ideological differences and party differences and regional differences and all these kinds of things, it's a pretty small club. And so the Senate tended to be more collegial than, say, the House, where you have 400 people who are only there for a couple of years and don't really know each other
necessarily. And are constantly running for re-election.
And constantly running for re-election. These are people who are, especially in sort of the, before, say, 2000, lots of senators would live in D.C. and stay in D.C. and they, knew each other, went over to dinner at each other's houses and these kinds of things. That kind of camaraderie in the Senate seems to be fading into the distance, in as much as I've not seen as much of that kind of bipartisan activity or at least socialization in the Senate the way that you used to.
And McCain
really sort of symbolized the last in some ways.
And lamented its passing and quite eloquently and quite, I think, I think he was quite fervent and sincere in that lamentation. Let me see. Okay, David, let me see if I can tie everything together we've talked about. I'm going to draw a line here. So
this I want to see.
we've discussed the removal of the Silent Sam statue, President Trump's growing legal travails, and the passing of John McCain. And of course, McCain and Trump were no friends, and Trump has, apart from expressing condolences for McCain's family, has said very little about McCain, and perhaps symbolic of this current moment and the passing of that the old ways of the Senate and the old ways of Washington, Senator McCain requested that President Trump not attend his funeral, and the eulogies will be delivered by President Obama and President Bush, which is interesting. So we have
two men who defeated him in campaign to the White House.
Yes. But that's that's a kind of nod, if you will, to the old way of doing things, and the passing of that. So President Trump's travails kind of represent the new politics. But in terms of Silent Sam and trying to relate all this together, Chuck Schumer, Democratic senator from New York, a liberal, again, this is a kind of nod to the old way of doing things, is suggesting, I think he's proposing, that the Russell Senate office building, where Senator McCain had his office, be renamed in honor of John McCain. And I think there will be widespread support for that. I think
there seems to be.
The vote will be 100-0, probably.
It'd be 99-0.
Sorry. Thank you. I want to ask you what you think about that, because Richard Russell was a senator from Georgia in the early 20th century. He was, in his lifetime, considered a titan and a lion of the Senate, which is why the building was named after him when he died. He was a Democrat of the old stripe, which is to say he was an arch segregationist and he was a white supremacist and a pretty bad guy by many of the standards that we would apply today. And renaming the building seems to be about honoring McCain, but also correcting a kind of slightly embarrassing...
Where McCain's office was.
Yes, it's where McCain's office was, but it's also, if you will, removing a monument, monument. I want to play devil's advocate here and push back a little bit. Richard Russell, not a good guy.
No.
I am not here to defend Richard Russell. But if one is thinking about the institution of the Senate and its important members of the Senate, he's one of the most significant senators of the 20th century. And removing his name from the building and replacing it with John McCain will feel good in the moment, because Russell's not very admirable and McCain has admirable qualities. But I would submit to you that 50 years from now, people might say, why is that building named the McCain Building? And maybe we should name it after so-and-so, because everybody's fades from memory after time. And is it appropriate to take Russell's name off the building and put McCain's on it, in your view?
Yeah, I think it's fine. I think the names you give to buildings aren't sacrosanct. I think if we choose to honor somebody, if we, in retrospect, realize that person is not as worthy as much respect as our grandfathers thought they were, the people in the past who erect monuments are not infallible. The fact that something is old and something has had a name for a period of time doesn't mean it needs to keep that name. And I guess I'm an iconoclast in that respect, but I'm happy to, take down racist senators and racist monuments, because that's not the world we want to create for our future. I mean, monuments are about trying to inscribe the values of the present and try to share that with the future. That's why you put monuments up, is so that people in the future will think about a particular thing, and a particular set of values. And I think rejecting the values that our ancestors had 100 years ago or 50 years ago is okay. And in fact, it would be preserving the memory, in public spaces in particular, of people and institutions who thought that some Americans were better than other Americans, I think is contrary to at least my understanding of what the United States is all about and what the United States should be in the future. So yeah, I'm fine with taking it down.
You? Okay. Yeah, I'm fine with it too. Yeah. I just thought I'd ask. It seemed that it's a kind of interesting. It's been a week that began with Silent Sam and ended with that.
There's people who say that sometimes when we take down a monument that we're erasing history, which is just nonsense.
But at this point, if we could erase the history of the Confederacy, that would be a good thing, notwithstanding it would endanger your job.
No, but I know. And there is no. History is not about. Monuments are about, in some ways, invariably about distorting history. It's about creating, things set in stone, where history is very much about interpreting the past and looking at it differently than people have looked at it previously. Otherwise, we'd all be out of work. what historians do is not build monuments, but often try to sort of say we're looking at the monuments the wrong way. And we need, I think, to... people are not going to forget about the Confederacy if we take down Silent Sam, nor are we going to forget about, Julian Carr or Russell or any of these other people if we rename buildings or take down statues. I think there are lots of people for whom there are no statues, and we seem to remember who they are. And I think that's, progress.
Right. Okay. I agree.
All right.
What's your last drop, David?
All right. So... over the weekend, in addition to hearing about the passing of Senator McCain, we heard about the passing of Jesse Lemish, who was a very important historian of the Revolutionary era.
Absolutely.
Somebody who published a lot of articles, not so many books, but his one article in particular that I remember reading in college, Jack Tar in the Streets, which was published in the William & Mary Quarterly in 1968, so 50 years ago. It was a groundbreaking work and looking at history from the bottom up and trying to sort of reconfigure how we think about the revolution, how we think about what America means and where America comes from. And so I want to point people to go and read that article, which I think, even though it's 50 years old, stands up pretty well.
It's a really, really, it's one of the first things I read in graduate school. It's an incredibly important article, and he was an incredibly important scholar. I never met him, unfortunately, although I've certainly seen a lot of activity on social media in the past 24 hours from friends and colleagues who did, who speak very, very highly of him as an individual,
scholar. He was very politically involved, thinking about, you know, his scholarship was very much about the dispossessed and the powerless and the ways in which those people who were in fact not powerless and had a great influence on politics and on the shape of American history. And I think he was very much simultaneously interested in questions about civil rights and human freedom and all that kind of stuff.
Well, so, he was an activist as well as a scholar, exactly. And in fact, that I think meant he did not get necessarily the academic career in terms of appointments that he might have had, and certainly that his scholarship warranted.
All right, what you got, Frank?
I want to recommend a relatively recent novel, although it's been out for a couple of years, Sebastian Barry's Days Without End.
Okay.
Which was, I think, long-listed for the Booker Prize. It's a wonderful novel. It's one of the best novels I've read in a couple of years. And it's a main among several different themes of the book is about the Irish in America, Irish immigrants in America during the middle of the 19th century, particularly before and after the Civil War.
Okay.
The main focus.
Oh, it's my time. Okay.
Yeah, it's your time. It's a character named Thomas McNulty, who, along with his lover John Cole, they're involved in the Indian Wars in the West at one point, prior to the Civil War and after the Civil War. They fight in the Civil War. They're imprisoned briefly in Andersonville.
Oh, geez.
It's some interesting material about Tennessee Unionist Reconstruction. It's
good
an incredibly
stuff.
Rich novel. It's beautifully written. And, I finished it last night and thought, wow, this is really good. And David would love it. And so
okay,
that's
good.
My last drop. So
well, I'm going to have to...
Days Without End by Sebastian
Barry. Now that I have a working eyes, again, I think I'm going to do some reading.
All right. Cheers, David.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is Professor of American History and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at WhiskeyRebelPod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.